Live and Lansing with Michael Cohen. This is More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS.
And we're back. Michael Cohen with producer Desi Simmons. A new report out of the University of Michigan finding that while sex offender registries may reduce the chance that they'll reoffend, publicizing sex offenders' identities may actually increase the chances they'll commit another sex crime. To talk about what's behind these findings, I'm joined by one of the authors of the report, University of Michigan law professor J.J. Prescott. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So you studied 10 years of data from 15 states. Let's start with the law that requires sex offenders to register with law enforcement. How much of an impact has that had on reducing rates of reoffense?
Well, you know, it's had a modest but, you know, measurable effect. I mean, on the order of between 1 and 10%. So these are significant findings, and you know, our take on the results is it's not a bad idea to make sure that people who we think have a high likelihood or at least some likelihood of recidivating relative to an everyday person, you know, the police should know where they are so they can talk to them, and if it looks like they might be involved in a crime, know where to find them.
I see. So 1 to 10% reduction in reoffense rates when the registry is in place. Are there any jurisdictions?
I should be clear, not in reoffense rates. So one important aspect of this study, there basically isn't the kind of data that would allow somebody to look at reoffense rates. What we do in this study is look at changes in law and how that law is being applied, and then look at the overall sex offense rate. And what we find is the overall number of sex offenses drops when registries start to come online. And the important thing about when registries come online is that they apply to either a small or a large number of people, depending on how they're designed and how they grow over time. And we find that the number of sex offenses drops by more the larger the registry is, suggesting that it is, in fact, coming from the registration program.
Is there a wide range of registry types, or do they typically include the same set of offenses?
In the 15 states we look at, you know, most of them, obviously, all of them will require registration for rape and child molestation and other kinds of violent crimes. Most of them, if not all, to be honest, it may well be all of them, will keep track of offenders who have engaged in anything that falls into the category of sex crime. Mm-hmm. There aren't that many strong arguments against the use of registration. It may be expensive to follow people, and it may be difficult sometimes for people who are required to register to do so. Costly, takes time out of their day fairly often. Every time they move, they need to make sure to update their registration, or else they could today be convicted of a federal offense. Mm-hmm. So it's not trivial. On the other hand, there isn't too much to worry about in terms of the costs in terms of crime, because you know, it's almost like an additional, I guess, a tax or something like that. And so we don't feel too worried about being over inclusive. So maybe even some, you know, a Romeo and Juliet crime, for example, we may think, listen, this person may not be that dangerous, but why take the risk? We can ask, you know, ask this person to provide their telephone number and their address and keep track of them just in case.
Now, it seems that many parents consider the publication of their local sex offenders as essential to feeling that their children are safe, although your study found that it doesn't necessarily lead to that goal. Can you explain that?
Sure. I mean, one of the problems, I guess, that's the right way to put it, with using notification systems or systems in which we publicize the names of sex offenders is that it does create this false impression that the biggest threat or the biggest source of sex offenses is actually a stranger, somebody you don't know, and that's not true. Most sex offenses are committed by people you're close to. That's true with basically every kind of sex offense. The other thing, even if we were mostly worried about stranger kinds of sex offenses, where the person who we're worried about is the person who lives down the street, you know, it's not clear at all that knowing that a sex offender lives nearby makes people feel safer, or actually makes them safer. In fact, oftentimes it makes people feel much less safe.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, if we really think that sex offenders are planning on committing crimes, interested in doing that sort of thing, attacking somebody right down the road probably isn't the place they're going to aim. So we wind up having is a situation where, if a sex offender, there's other work out there that suggests if a sex offender moves onto your block, your house, the price of your home will drop by 10%. And that actually may have nothing to do with whether or not the risk to you has gone up, but just the fact that people find it distasteful to live near sex offenders.
I'm talking to University of Michigan law professor J.J. Prescott about a report that he's worked on regarding the sex offender registry and the publicizing of these the identities of these offenders. Now, aren't sex offender registries and the publicizing of their identity, doesn't that usually go hand in hand?
I'm sorry, publicizing their...
Yeah, I mean, do we see a lot of jurisdictions where that information is not public?
Well, not anymore. This is a lot of these tools, registering them, following people who've been convicted of sex offenses, and then actually publicizing their names, began really in the late 80s and early 90s. But by 1996, the federal government passed its version of Megan's Law, which essentially requires that at least the most serious kinds of offenders be subject to these kinds of provisions. So, yeah, you're right in the sense that every state now must maintain a database that provides this sort of information.
So what were your findings? That the initial registry saw a drop in the sex crime rates, and then publicizing the identity then raised that rate?
Well, so there are the way these laws evolved, essentially two stages. The first technology was, and I'm using the phrase technology sort of broadly, but technology was let's keep everybody's information. In fact, the earliest versions of registration laws required that information be kept confidential. The police were going to use it to monitor people, make sure they stayed out of trouble, but were otherwise not going to make it public. A few years later, states started making that information public, the thought being, listen, why just let the police do the monitoring? Why can't we allow individuals out there in the world to sort of keep an eye on the offenders near them, report in if they see something unusual? And what we find is registration, where it's kept confidential, seems to be fairly effective at reducing the crime rate. And presumably, at least our data suggests, through the reduction in recidivism. Notification laws, when they came on, I think it's clear to say there is some deterrent value of these. In other words, they create such a, people really don't want to be, I know it's not surprising, really don't want to be on these public registries. It's not a pleasant thing to be known in public as a sex offender. And so we actually see some immediate decline in the number of sex offenses, which may be due, seems likely to us, and our evidence, our data suggests it is due to deterrence. So we have that as an advantage of notification. But once somebody is a sex offender, has committed one of these sex offenses, and they're released out into the public, making their identity public, maybe it does, and certainly in some cases it does, allows the public to protect itself and allows some public monitoring, mm-hmm. but it also tends to make the lives of these individuals absolutely miserable. Now, I should be clear. I think it's up to us as citizens to decide whether or not we want to make the lives of these individuals miserable mm-hmm. for all sorts of reasons. We could decide that that's the right thing to do, but it's a different thing from a public safety perspective if we make their lives miserable and they're out in the public. And the reason why is because what threat is there of sending somebody back to prison if their life is as miserable as it would be in prison when they're out?
One last question, about a minute left now. Once listed on a sex offender registry, do most jurisdictions have a process to allow someone to at some point be removed from the list, or is it a lifetime distinction?
That's changed a lot over time. The minimum under the federal laws that compel these requirements now is 10 years, and most states now have lifetime registration for the most serious crimes. A number of jurisdictions will allow discretionary release from these obligations an ending of these obligations after some number of years. But I think 10 years is the very minimum, and it's not that common anymore.
I can't imagine the public and parents generally in any way supporting reversing this this policy of publicizing the identity of sex offenders. Is that likely to remain with us for the foreseeable future?
I think it is, and so what that means is if the effects of notification of making these names public has the effect of making their lives so miserable that they become more likely to commit the offense rather than less likely to commit the offense, what we need to do is combine notification with some other set of policies that gives them something to lose, that makes them want to stay out of prison. People will know who they are, will steer clear of them, they won't have many opportunities to attack people, and yet at the same time, they will have something in their life, something worth working for and staying on the straight and narrow. We need to figure out what those policies are.
University of Michigan law professor J.J. Prescott, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.